yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, the show, Alternative Visions. Okay, last week, at the end of the last week's show, we indicated we would be discussing today the militarization of police and the urban shield topic. That's been postponed 1 week. We'll pick that up next week. And in the space today, we wanted to talk about something more topical and immediate, right? And the topic today returns us back to a theme we've been revisiting on numerous occasions over the past year, and that is American labor unions at a strategic impasse? That means not just political strategy, but organizing strategy, bargaining strategy, and so forth. Is American labor at a dead end? We've been talking to people like Ray Rogers, Greg Shotwell, UAW, Jerry Gordon, Boeing IAM workers, and so forth, periodically, at least once a month over the past year. And we're going to pick up that theme again. And today's guest is Chris Silvera in New York City, Teamsters Local 808. Okay, and his local represents a number of city workers, also railroad workers on the northern line going out of New York to the north, airport workers, and so forth. Quite an important local in New York City, quite an important city and location in the U.S. as far as labor is concerned. Well, Chris is a longtime New York City local union labor leader. He's done it all in the trenches for years, decades, organizing, negotiating, strikes, and so forth. Chris also has deep roots in the community. I believe he goes back to Jamaica, his roots. One of these rare birds, community-oriented labor leader. Chris and I have been involved with joint activities over the years here, Million Worker March and other events. And I can say that Chris is someone who has an instinctive, natural feel and understanding for what solidarity means, which only comes from years of direct labor struggles down there in the trenches. So we want to add Chris's voice to our analysis of where is labor today and where it's going, but we'll talk about that more in the second half of the show. In the first half, I want Chris to really give us his view, since his local has a big stake in what's happening with these negotiations pending and strike possible here within a few, I think it's like 7 or 11 days or something, with the Long Island Railroad workers. Now, there's a number of railroad lines going into New York City, and as I said, Chris represents workers going north, but the other big railroad line comes in from Long Island. And, of course, Chris, I'm sure, is in close communication with the other unions that have the Long Island Railroad line here. So he's in a good position to tell us what's going on. And his views, by the way, and the others we've been talking about, will be published soon in print in interview form. We will let them speak them for themselves here based on this theme of where is labor today, where is it going. But in the first half, we want Chris to give us his views on what's going on in New York City labor, especially the Long Island Railroad negotiations and potential strike going on there. There's some early signs of organized labor sort of awakening of late. I don't want to overemphasize that, but there are some signs, and of course, at the grassroots. We see minimum wage fights erupting across the country in various cities, and some gains there, starting, you know, on the West Coast with Seattle, but seems to be spreading. We've seen fast food workers organizing strikes and demanding better wages and conditions, nurses and healthcare workers in the South organizing. We we've seen some growing opposition to Obama's Affordable Care Act, which promises, when it's fully implemented by 2018, to destroy union-negotiated health care plans. L.A. teachers, even the UAW's new leader came out and said, no more concessions, auto companies. Well, I don't want to emphasize this too much. We shall see. But he did put a stake in the ground publicly, and that's a little indication of maybe a change even at the top here. Although, as you know, from what I say, and this change has to come from below. It's got to come from the locals, local unions, and so forth. So is New York City labor awakening here? Well, New York City is one of the most important barometers of change in the USA, and popular resistance and so forth. After all, this is a home of Occupy Wall Street. they recently elected what appears to be a liberal mayor, Blasio, right, who promises to act like a Democrat of old. Well, that's a rare bird. I thought they had all but gone extinct, Democrats of old. I thought they were all looking to transform themselves to Republican lights. Well, we shall see what this guy does, Blasio. And, of course, the issue here, as I see it from afar, is what's labor going to do about maintenance of benefits? Well, what is maintenance of benefits, the mob strategy? Well, that's the main bargaining strategy most unions have been following for the last 20 years. That is, we'll give up wage increases to hold on to our health care and pensions. We'll put money in health care and pensions, and we'll give up wage increases. And, of course, management likes to do that because management can write off the cost of their taxes of increases in their payments for benefits. So, actually, you know, their bottom line looks like they save money, reduce their total costs. By not giving wage increases and putting the money instead in benefit increases. And that's been sort of the model more or less for the last 20 years. But now we've got a big political attack going on against the benefit plans. The Affordable Care Act means, as I said, the end of union-negotiated health care plans coming up by 2018. And we have an attack on pensions all along the line, converting them to contribution plans and consolidating them and changing them to cash balance plans and so forth. But we'll have another show on all that. So we have a big attack on this whole idea going on. We've given up, labor's given up wages for 20 years to keep its benefits, and now they're taking the benefits away. So we gave up the 20 years. And now we see benefits under attack here. And benefits are at the heart, I think, of this Long Island Railroad issue, where workers are clearly going to be given a modest wage increase. But when management gives with one hand, it takes back with the other. And in other words, the little bit of wages they're going to get, they're going to have to use to pay for benefits. And management's counter strategy for the last 20 years has been, we're going to take away your benefits here and hold that over your head, right? And then we're going to make the new workers pay. In other words, we'll do this. We'll agree to MOB for the existing workers. But the new workers are going to take it in the ear. They're not even going to get the wage increases, you know, two tiers, lump sums, and all that nonsense. Okay, so all these issues are reflected, I believe, in the Long Island Railroad negotiations. And we'll see if New York City can take the lead and where it may be going. Maybe this isn't a test case here, but we'll see. Certainly it's a potential test case for Democrats and the political strategy of labor, because the unions have appealed to Governor Cuomo, a Democrat, and to Blasio, and they even sent delegations to Congress saying, oh, please, politicians, help us out here. You know, I think they're going to be rudely awakened. I don't think the politicians are going to help them. But, of course, Labor puts the politicians in office, right? Make sure they get elected, the Democrats, and then the Democrats turn around and they say, F you. Okay. So, Chris, are you there?
Yes, sir, I am.
I've had my say, my rant here on this topic, and now we're going to let someone who really knows what's going on over there talk about it. Chris, as I said earlier, I'd like you to tell us more about the facts of what's going on here with the Long Island Railroad negotiations. And we'll discuss that in the first half. And then in the second half, I want to get your very important views on this whole question, is American labor at a strategic impasse, and what can we do about it, particularly at the local level, local union level, because I don't think any change is going to come anywhere but that. But let's hold the broader question off to the second half after the break. At midday, and tell us what's happening with Long Island Railroad. Tell us the facts, not what the New York Times tells us.
Right. Well, so the workers on the Long Island, as well as Metro North, Long Island serving Long Island, the eastern end of New York City being the center. So Long Island comes from the east into Manhattan, Metro North coming from the north, as well as Connecticut into Manhattan, serving Wall Street and the corporate banking structure.
And your local represents the Metro North Railroad workers, right?
We represent a portion of the Metro North workers, the track and B&B workers. So we've been without a contract, both Long Island and Metro North, now since the summer of 2010.
Wow.
And in essence, the MTA and Governor Cuomo has said that we had to take 4 years of no wage increases. They've come with what is known as net zero contracts, in which they'll give you some money in the wages but take it all back in co-payments and work rule changes and so forth. This was roundly rejected by the workers on the Long Island Railroad. In fact, on Metro North, there is a what is identified and believed to be a company-sponsored association, the Association of Commuter Rail Employees, and they put a net zero contract out for vote, and those affected workers rejected it hands down. So this struggle has continued. They finally got a chance to go to what is known as a presidential emergency board. This board is designed to make recommendations, not binding, but recommendations that would bring resolution. It was designed to avoid strikes. The MTA has rejected the board's recommendation, both the first presidential emergency board and the second board, which does, so the first board writes a recommendation, listens to both parties. The second board actually has a choice of accepting the company's recommendation or proposal or accepting the union's proposal. They accepted the union's proposal because the union's proposal mirrored the first board's recommendation.
And what was the proposal's main elements?
It provided for modest wage increases. There was a medical co-payment of 2% of wages, which, you know, in light of what people in the private sector are paying, was a reasonable thing, going from, you know, not paying anything at all to two, so we could cry as well as the rest of America. So now they're 8 days away from the right to strike.
Okay, and so MTA, that's the management, right? That's
right.
The Metropolitan Transport Authority, right? In New York,
right.
That's management.
No. The Port Authority is a separate. The Port Authority is a separate authority. The MTA is the umbrella that runs the Long Island Railroad, the certain bridges in and around New York City, Metro North, the subway and bus system, and they used to run a couple of little bus services. So
okay.
That's a big umbrella transportation authority, in which all the others are subsets of.
Okay. So what's the difference in the central issues, differences in main contention between what management has proposed and what the unions have proposed, and what this board, apparently agreeing with the union, has supported?
Well, you know, as well, the company wants to get an opportunity to give the least to the workers. So the struggle is trying to get what the board recommended, or as much of that as possible, and the company is trying to water that down as much as possible, which is going to lead to this tension that comes to a head on July the 20th. I can tell you that the Long Island workers have the full support of the Metro North workers, and my suspicion is that if it actually has a strike, the strike has the potential for not only affecting the Long Island Railroad, but actually spilling over and affecting Metro North, and that would then become Andrew Cuomo's Waterloo, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about pretty much shutting down New York City, because where is it? 300,000, 400,000 people ride these railroads in and out of New York City every day.
Right. So if you put the two of them together, you're talking about 600,000 to 700,000 people that couldn't get to work.
Wow.
You know, Long Island would become one gigantic parking lot. They have no ability to prepare to handle that kind of an outcome, where they could move people in any kind of acceptable, efficient fashion, even an inefficient fashion. There's no way to accommodate that. There's not enough buses. There's not enough school buses. There's not enough. They couldn't do it. It would just be one fiasco on the workers. But what needs to happen, though, is that people don't need to look at this, or should stop looking at this, as the union against Metro North. The unions are the army of the American working class. When the unions win, all of America wins. Every worker wins every time a union picks up a victory. And so that even though some people think they're in management, usually when they get laid off or their company shuts down and sticks it up their behind, they figure out, holy smoke, I'm really not a manager, I'm a worker. There needs to be a consciousness that's developed in these struggles. And this is what is really lacking amongst the union movement. The union movement is really abdicating its leadership role, not for itself, but for the class, for all those people who are required to get up, go into an office, hit a clock, you know, manufacture something, but not much of that's taking place. And really recognize and explain to people that, you know, when they talk about the turnaround of the auto industry and they're praising all these corporate mucky mucks, the turnaround was taken out of the pocket of the workers. The workers paid for that. This is not some managerial genius that was coming out of Detroit. This was simply, listen, we're just going to steal from the workers. We're going to take it from their pocketbooks and pay off the debt to the government. So the workers get to pay twice. They get their tax dollars put up to bail them out, and then their wages are taken away from them to pay it off. And people need to begin to understand what the struggle is really about and ask the question, from the working class, what kind of America do you want?
Very well put. Very well put. And again, it sounds like in New York City here, as we've seen on other issues in New York City of late, the main strategies of both sides are coming to a head. This whole idea of maintenance of benefits. The real issue sounds to me like making workers pay more on the railroad there for their benefits. It doesn't sound like wages are a real issue. Looks like about a 2% wage increase, maybe, and the parties aren't that far apart. But the benefit takeaways are paying more if you want to keep your benefits seems to be the issue. Is that correct? Am I reading that right?
It is a combination of both, certainly to maintain benefits. What they want to happen is to actually split the class, you know, within the union, so that the older workers will have one thing and the newer workers will have something else. And that the pensions that the newer workers have, they will actually have paid for it in its entirety. You know, the health coverage that they have, when you talk about taking 4%, out of somebody's pocket for the next 30 years, when you're talking about taking 4% for their pensions for the next 30 years, I mean, if you could save 4% of your wages for the day you got half for 30 years, you had your own pension.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
So
right.
it's really moving the benefit so that the worker actually pays for their own benefit and the company gets to keep their money in their pocket. And so that the MTA is really just exacerbating what is happening in the private sector of corporate America, in which they've transitioned to these, you know, 401ks and cash value plans, which at the end of 30 years leave the worker with not much to retire on.
Yeah, the actual national numbers, I think, for balances in 401k plans is less than $20,000.
Yeah,
that's what's
yeah.
in the average 401k plan. How are you going to live on $20,000? Even those who are about to retire have no more than $50,000 on average.
That's right.
So
if you are a meticulous person and you have $200,000, you're going to spend to survive $25,000, $30,000, $40,000 a year. Right?
It doesn't
last long. So you're living longer. In 5 to 10 years, assuming everything went wonderfully for you, you were broke.
Yeah. Well, you know, people aren't aware that the fastest growing segment of the labor force, in other words, people entering the labor force, are people 65 to 74. In other words, people are going back to work because their 401ks and all the bullshit pensions and so forth is not enough to live on.
That's right.
People that age should be retiring. Get the hell out of there. Let the younger workers take the jobs, you know?
That's right.
They can't afford to do so.
They can't afford to do it.
No.
And the labor movement has abdicated its struggle, you know? So they put their resources in trying to get people elected who, if they've looked over the last 30 years, all the money they have spent on elections have not produced for them any result that makes the investment a valuable investment. And if the labor movement was smart, it would take those resources and begin to target the working class, begin to create its own message, you know, speaking in its own name and not carrying some Democratic message or some Republican message, but carry a workers' message, and that would change the dynamic of what was happening in America.
In the last two national elections, 2012 and 2008, unions have put in about $1 billion in contributions to Democrats, and what the hell have they gotten for it? A couple of NRB appointments, maybe? You know, I don't see anything else, and we're pumping all the... But this is a question of the bigger political strategy. Let's hold that for the second half.
But
if we... You know, I mean, obviously they're closely related here, what's happening, the strategy. But I want to emphasize for the listeners the point that you just made, and that is management strategy here, which is strategy in the private and public sector going on for years now, is make the new hired workers pay for whatever the company agrees to give to the existing workers. In other words, divide and conquer, split. And
That's right.
It sounds to me, correct me if I'm wrong, that in this agreement proposal by management and with the Long Island Railroad situation is they want to make new workers pay 4% of their salary,
right,
their wages, for their benefits. So they are taking 4% from them, right, and putting it
in
for health care. Oh, is it health care or is it pensions?
And another 4% for pensions. So
8% plus 4%, 8%?
That's right. 8%
more. Oh, my goodness. Goodness. Whoa. 8% out of their paychecks, make them pay. Management won't put anything in.
Right.
In order to give, what, a 2% raise to existing workers?
That's right.
A year?
That's right.
2%, but then even existing workers are going to have to take that 2% and pay for their increased costs out of pocket, right?
That's right. Let me tell you. Gentleman Dean DeVita just talked about what the cost of gasoline was in 2010 versus today, what the cost of a pound of sausage was in 2010 versus today. So even these wage increases that they would get would not even keep them in level with inflation.
Which
you know,
is now running at least 2% per year. So all these workers in New York have not gotten any wage increases since 2010 to begin with.
That's
and
right.
Now they're offering them a 2%, which
let
just covers inflation now.
Let me just give you a little, because maybe to create a little bit more clarity.
Okay.
The last wage increase was January of 2009, which took them to... So the contract expired in the summer of 10. So they got a modest wage increase in 09, I believe it was about 2%, that then spilled over all the way into 2010. When so if you spread it out from, which is an 18-month span, it's no longer 2%.
Mm-hmm.
So then the recommendation now says that there would be no wage increase from July of 2010 to December of 2010. So you now actually went a complete year without a wage increase and 2 years from your last wage increase. You see what I'm saying?
And so, have they gotten anything since 2010 up to the present?
No.
Oh, okay. So a 5-year wage freeze, you might say.
That's right.
And now... they're going to give you 2%, but you're going to have to use that to pay for your increased cost of health care, and new workers are going to have to pay 8%.
That's right.
Wow. No wonder they're looking to walk out on this, right?
That's right. And it complements to the leadership over there, in particular General Chairman Anthony Simon from SMART. He said that he will not allow his workforce to be divided between older workers and younger workers, which is the same policy we carried on Metro North when we made our last agreement. We said all for one and one for all. Whatever's going to happen is going to happen to the old as well as to the new, the good of it and the bad of it. You know, so because it's already difficult to unite the class. Just within a small framework like conductors or track workers, it's hard enough to unite 600 workers. So if you now have 400 workers getting left-handed stuff and 300 workers getting right-handed stuff, how do you unite? And then unite around what?
Yeah,
so
but
this,
what you just
this
described...
division,
what you've just described, Chris, has been the practice of unions for a decade now. In other words, leaders willing to do just what you say should never be done, and that is splitting their own workforce, their own membership, by making the new ones, the young ones, pay for the scraps for the older ones. Boy, that's a management strategy that they've just absorbed and, agreed to.
Most of these leaders are coming from, they're not coming out of the trenches. You know, if you look at most unions today, they're not being led by people that came out of the trenches. They're being led by people that came in as staff people, came in at some higher level. Some of them came in on a genetic trail. You know, they're not coming from a place of struggle.
Uh-huh.
Right. So actually what's happening right now is the full blossom of two things, Camp Hartley and McCarthyism. And both of those two things are now in full bloom. So anyone, go ahead.
I want you to hold that thought. We're going to take a break. Let's come right back with that thought. Those full bloom, you know, McCarthyism. That's interesting. I'd like to see what your thoughts are there. And Taft-Hartley, and we'll explain that for people who don't know what Taft-Hartley is, but you're absolutely right. Okay, so let's take a brief break here. We're at the bottom of the hour, and we're going to come back and continue with Chris talking about those two themes and segueing from there into this broader question and to what extent New York Long Island Railroad struggle may represent a break from this past 20 years of strategies by labor, allowing divide and conquer, maintenance of benefits, and so on and so forth, that got us into this impasse, as I believe, that has to be broken. And I agree with you, Chris, it's got to come from the bottom. It's got to come from real people who are involved in the real situation. But let's take a quick break. Alternative Vision, we're going to come back, pick this up, and the broader significance of what we're talking about with the railroad workers in New York City. This is Alternative Visions. Be back shortly.
Now sometimes tomorrow comes soaked in treasure and blood. Here we stood the job. Now we'll stand the flood.
Stay tuned to PRN.FM for more empowering ideas from Progressive Voices. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Hello, this is Richard Martin to remind you that I'll be looking out for you on Mondays and Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time to give you the latest from the financial world and to let you know just how bad things are getting. Be telling you things you'll never get to hear in the mainstream media. So join me here on the Wake Up Call. You can listen to the show at any time from the archives, and if you like the show, rate us on iTunes. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
This is PRN.FM, giving you a daily progressive take on the world.
Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions, and we're talking today with my guest, Secretary Treasurer of Teamsters Local 808 in New York City, Chris Silvera. And we've been focusing in the first half on this Long Island Railroad workers' negotiations and potential strike occurring in just 8 days here. And again, I want folks to realize, 600,000-700,000 people ride the railroads in New York. I mean, it just gives you an indication of the massive potential power of labor here. They could shut down New York City if they wanted and negotiate whatever the hell they wanted. And again, that's the power of labor if it takes up that power and uses it. And, of course, the Long Island Railroad situation, I think, represents this coming to a head of strategies employed by management and employed by labor coming to an impasse now. They no longer work for labor, and management keeps playing the same old cards. But we see in a Long Island railroad situation how little the workers really have on the table for themselves in this whole agreement, and they're trying, the management's trying to pit the new workers against old or existing workers. In other words, move the money around, negotiations I used to call it, to move the money around. In fact, I wrote a song about that once, moving the money around, in my play Fire on Pier 32. There's a song, Moving the Money Around. And that's what they do in negotiations. They say, oh, well, this is all you're going to get, but you can put it wherever you want. You know, it's a game. And you know that game. You've been up against it a lot, I'm sure. But you said at the break here, Chris, two things. One, how the condition of labor has something to do in New York City in general with Taft-Hartley on the one hand and McCarthyism. Well, yeah. I'm curious to see how you how that ties in. What do you mean?
Well, the labor movement in the United States is built by people that are considered to be socialists, communists, left-wing, radicals. Okay? So McCarthyism required that these people be dragged and taken out of the labor movement. Those people are replaced by staffism, corporatism, intellectualism, and the radicalism is destroyed. On the other side of it is Taft-Hartley. And Taft-Hartley is a law that's put into place to stymie the growth and the methodology that workers were using to organize and to express their power in confrontations with the boss. So those two things combined, in fact, if people go backwards into the 50s and study carefully, there was a gentleman out of local 668 in St. Louis whose name escapes me right now, who recognized the stagnation of the labor movement, of the growth and move of and power of the labor movement in 66. He already identified it. So if you come full forward, in which the mechanism of getting to the top of the union, nobody wants a guy to be his leader who doesn't wear a suit well, who doesn't wear a tie well, who doesn't have an attaché case. We are not electing people that came off of the floor, because that person, we are electing people who look like our congressman, who does nothing for us. And so if you even look within the Teamsters, which has rank and file elections for leadership, it mirrors the behavior of a Democrat versus Republican type of an election, where how much money you have, how glossy your paraphernalia is, gets you into power. And anyone that's coming from a grassroots, quasi-radical perspective, or somewhat left perspective, or somewhat worker-centric, because I think when you put all those pieces together, it's really a worker-centric perspective. When those people come to the table, no one wants to hear it, because we are afraid of struggle in the 21st century. You know, but my brother Clarence says we had two things that were killing the labor movement right now, and it's black ignorance and white supremacy. And those two things combined is destroying the labor movement, because the black workers who are getting the least of this have an ignorance that cannot be sustained. And the white worker believes that he is invested in this system and therefore doesn't give a damn which way it goes, because he believes he is invested. But if we actually look statistically, both sides would realize that the Koch brothers and all these different people don't care about either one. You are not of my class. You are not a part of the ruling class. You're not a part of the billionaire class. You're not a part of the we don't pay any taxes class. And therefore, those people, so we have to really recreate and restructure the struggle from a class perspective.
Well, I think for the listeners, McCarthyism, as you use it, really means the system has evolved to make sure that real rank-and-file workers don't get in the leadership of their locals, right? And, yeah, I would agree with you. I think that's one of the big problems. This web of law and decisions, legal decisions, has built up since 1947. Taft-Hartley kicked it all off. And by the way, for listeners, Taft-Hartley is this 1947 law, which pretty much pulled the fangs of labor as far as striking is concerned. Made it extremely difficult to strike, and then there were other laws in the 1950s, Landon Griffin and others, that really put the fear of God into labor leaders. And ever since then, we've had all kind of board and court decisions that have come that have, I believe, created a system in which the leaders, particularly the top leaders of labor, national leaders of labor, are given extreme power to come down on their own locals when they don't follow the national union line. But the other hand, these same national leaders are have very little power when it comes to the political system, the court system, when it wants to come down on their ass. They've created a legal situation where the top labor leaders pretty much have control of the locals. Local unions have a great difficulty in going their own route if it bucks the national union leadership, because the contracts now, because of legal decisions, are all in the name of the national union. They have a right to come down and take away your contracts from you if you don't do what they want you to do. Great powers at the national level versus the local leader level. Great powers there have been created, and at the same time, great powers for capital and politicians to come down on national labor leaders if they don't play the ball. That's the new system that's evolved here, and it began with Taft-Hartley, I agree, but it's a lot more than Taft-Hartley today. It's the web, the big web that has tied labor in so many knots, and I think the only way that web is going to be broken has to be from the bottom up, has to be from locals, but I think a whole new form of local union structure and organization has to occur. But I'll talk about that in future days. I don't think you're going to do anything from top down. It's going to have to be from bottom up, but we're going to have to restructure what a local union looks like and can do strategically and so forth to break this legal web.
That's right.
So, McCarthyism. We don't have the kind of labor leaders we used to have. it sounds like staffism, corporatism, intellectual. It sounds like they're bringing in people who aren't really from the class itself, you might
That's
say.
Right.
You know, to run the locals and certainly run at the national level more and more, you see this occurring. I think that's it. Am I correct? That's kind of what you meant by McCarthy.
That is exactly.
In other words, let's purge militant local. Don't let militant local people from the class take over and run these locals and run the unions. That's the number one thing.
That's right, and people see it. So if you're living in it and you see the outcomes, then you learn very early to curb your enthusiasm. I won't even call it militancy. Mm-hmm. Curb your enthusiasm quick, or you don't get that promotion to the international.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You don't get that promotion to the joint councils and the district councils.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you a for instance, not to be so... I mean, they're already mad with me, but let me try to calm them down a little. So as not to be critical.
Uh-huh.
We have a New York State Conference of Teamsters that brings together all the Teamster locals from across New York State. One of the questions I'm going to ask them is, in the years since we have created this, what benefit have we had from this so-called unity that I'm missing? Here's why I tell you that. I have asked them to invite you. I've asked them to invite Clarence Thomas to come out and to speak, to get some alternative views on what's going on, to get some alternative analysis other than the analysis that we already get every day from CNN, our international, MSNBC, the Democratic Party, and so forth. Oh, well, Chris, you know, if you come up with the money and get somebody to sponsor them, we'll let them speak, but we don't have enough money to pay for it. However, we have a boat ride that takes place every year. Now, I love the boat ride. Don't get me wrong. A matter of fact, I have skipped the entire conference and gone just for the boat ride. So I love sailing up and down Lake George. Don't get me wrong. However, what was this coming together about if we are not getting alternative voices in there, if we are not hearing some alternative thought processes, you know, deliberations, reading material that can come to the table and make somebody think, holy smoke, I didn't think about that before. Wow, glad to have met you. Glad to have read your book. You see the point I'm saying?
Yep.
Towing the line that's coming from Washington, because every one of these unions' headquarters are in Washington, and they're all towing the line of the Democratic Party. You can't tell the last time you heard a labor so-called leader talk about striker replacement legislation. Hasn't happened since Al Gore lost the election.
Mm-hmm.
That was the last time you heard that discussion. That's because we toe the line of the Democratic Party. We are afraid to piss Barack Obama off. What? Afraid of what? What is he going to do? Can he do anything worse?
You may not get that appointment to the National Labor Relations Board. Whoopee, big deal, you know?
Let me tell you something. It ain't doing them any good anyway.
Well, that's the point, yeah. It doesn't do any damn good, but, you know, they sit on, you know, all any kind of local union militancy. I mean, look at what happened in Wisconsin. Look at, you know, teachers' unions and all
That's
over.
Right.
Whenever the local folks want to fight, they come in and say, oh, you can't do that. And they cool them off and discourage them and say, oh, the politicians, Democrats will take care of us, which they don't. And everything blows over.
That's
and,
right.
Then, you know, you're back to where you were. And, you know,
we went out to Cleveland. Did you go to Cleveland for the emergency labor thing?
Yes, I did. Yes, I did.
Right? We articulated in Cleveland that there had to be a militant act and recall elections and what have you like that. Hey, listen, this guy was elected. He didn't commit no crime. How are you going to recall me? You got to have militant action that forces him to change his direction. You don't have to. So what happens now? So they have a recall election that they lose. All of the militancy that was built up inside that Capitol building and around Wisconsin was diffused for an election that they lost. So what happened to those workers?
They knew they were going to lose it. They knew they were going to lose it, too. Yeah, they picked the guy that already had lost against the Republican Walker. They picked him again, right?
Exactly.
And then no one put any money in there. The Democrats didn't even come in and support their own guy. Barack Obama, who said he would support public workers, stood away, said nothing. I mean, it was all a fix. It was a fix in to pull the teeth of the Wisconsin uprising and, you know, put things back where they were.
That's right.
If we in labor don't learn to fight, we've almost lost the knowledge of how to fight. You know, the strategy and tactics. I mean, we had a BART strike out here not too long ago, and the workers, you know, the BART workers themselves were sort of in control at the beginning. There was some militancy, but then, you know, top labor leaders stepped in. They made sure the workers weren't talking to the press. They sort of bottled it all up.
That's exactly right.
But you know the whole strategy, how that's done. You know, you've seen it. I've seen it many times. But
because most of them have something to lose that you don't know about.
That's right. Yep.
Right?
Yep.
So, yep. So if you look at Richard Trumka, Richard Trumka took the Fifth Amendment, exercises Fifth Amendment rights, which according to the AFL-CIO Constitution, if you do that, you actually have to step down from your position. Richard Trumka not only exercises Fifth Amendment rights, Richard Trumka then became the head of the AFL-CIO. So when Richard jumps up to say something too loud, a guy just simply reminds him, hey, Rich, you know, don't forget, man, that, you know, you don't want us to bring this up, do you? Oh, you're right. Sorry, I lost my mind for a minute. You know, so whatever Richard might want to do in his heart, somebody yanks on his shoulder and reminds him that he had better think twice. And this goes for a lot of these trade union leaders. They are comfortable going to dinner. They're comfortable going out and having wonderful meals and watching the Super Bowl at the White House and all these things, but have no capacity to move the ball forward on behalf of their membership. And the membership is so glad to just be holding on that they are thankful just to be holding on. They're not even trying to go forward. Just don't let me fall.
Well, that's what maintenance of benefits is all about. Just hold on to what you got, you know. But as
just
I said, they played that game with us for 20 years, and now they're going to take away what they let us hold on to, you know. So that whole bargaining strategy is now dead in the water. You know, we're losing pensions, we're losing health care. I mean, 2018, the Obama HCA means a 40% tax on all union-negotiated health care plans. That's the end.
That's the end of it.
Union-negotiated health care plans, you know? So you're giving up all this money to put money into health care. Now where are you after 20 years? Nowhere.
That's right.
And the same game is being played with pensions, right?
But when I say
we're at a strategic dead end as far as bargaining strategy is concerned. We've been going backwards on wages ever since.
That's right. The ultimate step requires that organized labor, along with a lot of this grassroots movement, our low-wage workers, minimum-wage workers, day laborers, so forth and so on, that we converge into a movement like the 8-hour movement. And this is what Million Worker March was designed to do. One of the things that came out of the Million Worker March movement was my opportunity to have met you, to have met Clarence, to have met my man with the video thing out there in San Francisco. Steve Zeltzer, you know, to just start to hear and to meet again, Leo Robinson, you know, the type of militancy that allowed the workers to get that pension, to allow the workers to get that health care, and then recognizing what is required to take it to the next level, not just to protect and hold on, but to actually move the ball forward.
And I believe, if I can take up that point, we're not going to reform the national union leaders. And I don't think the legal web is such that you can change the labor movement by trying to take over these national union leaders. And some say, you know, that's where the whole focus should be. As you describe, it's a problem. I think that's a dead end. I don't think it's going to be possible. You're like running your head into a brick wall by trying to do that, because the whole system is set up to maintain them and that. What we have to do is organize something new and different at the grassroots roots level. The idea that we have of local unions, the way they are structured, I think the organizational question is key here, has to change. I got some ideas. I haven't expressed them yet, but I will in future shows and in a publication coming out. We have to engineer a new kind of local union organization, and one that will embrace community militant groups. And this is kind of a radical idea. Yes, so labor community alliances aren't a radical idea. No, but the structure of how this could work that would provide a shield against the legal weapons that, you know, the bosses have.
I don't disagree.
And their right-hand arm, which is when things get out of hand locally, they pull the national leaders to do the job for them. We've got to create something different at the local level, organizational, structurally, and a movement at the local level. That's the only hope going forward.
Because you have a point, but that's a very difficult thing to do. But I'm going to offer you another suggestion, that when you have an infestation in your house of vermin, rats or cockroaches, you don't burn down your house.
That's true. Absolutely.
Okay. You spray some road spray and you set some rat traps and you get rid of them and take your house back. And that's what we have to do. We already have an infrastructure that people have fought for a long, long time, and I'm not about to yield it to the vermin that's in my house. I'm going to get rid of the vermin and retake my house. And that's what workers have to do. Workers have to start going back to union meetings. Workers have to start getting back to asking questions. Workers have to start to get back to getting involved every day in what's taking place around them, because the vermin cannot stand the light of day. The vermin cannot stand the question and answer, because they have no answer. And the workers are going to recognize that they have no answers and drive them out of town. But you the quest for the easier thing to do is to start to mobilize those members to begin to become involved in what's happening in my local union every day. Going to the meeting, going to the demos, going to the different events that their unions have, and starting to put the questions on the table. Let me tell you something, they're like cockroaches. You turn on the light, they got to go. What they've been successful in doing is keeping everybody in the dark.
Let me play devil's advocate to that point. What if the workers aren't coming to the union meetings because they don't think anything can really change?
That's why they don't come.
They don't see a way to change it. They're discouraged. And because they're discouraged, they don't do what you're saying has to be done. I agree. But maybe they need some new kinds of disinfectant to get rid of the vermin, because the old stuff doesn't work, and the bugs, the vermin, have become immune to the old chemicals. What we need is some new kind of disinfectant if we're going to chase them out.
We need to build the leadership. One of the things that we try to do in Noka Later Way is to pull members in, and we actually now, when you come to a demo, when you come to different events, we actually now give you a different T-shirt than we would give a regular member. So people would know, hey, where'd you get that, man? Well, we got that for being involved, you know. Mm-hmm. So we start to encourage people. And I tell my members, I said, listen, I'm here for a time. When I stop producing an outcome that satisfies you, it is your obligation to vote me out. That's your obligation. I'm here to do a work. When that work is not getting done, your job is to fire me and find somebody else who can. So there's two things that need to happen. And one is, you know, that external grassroots mobilization, but not at the point of abdicating the resources and the forwardness that we have built to this point. You know, so as long as it's going to merge back at some point, so we're going to take people outside. We did that with the Black Caucus. When we had the Black Caucus, we would educate members. And, I mean, there's a guy up in your area, too many names, too many people, too much old age. His name will come to me.
That's
encouraged.
Okay.
by being a part of the Black Caucus, that he went and ran as an individual against Chuck Master. You know, Chuck Master is a very popular teacher.
Right.
And he won the vice presidency in that local against the slate. The Tea Party is actually disenfranchised workers. The base of this Tea Party, the people they're talking to every day that are pissed off, these are people that lost good jobs, lost pensions, lost health care, and instead of thinking about how to fight to get it back, they're thinking about how I'm going to get the next guy to lose his so that misery will have company. And
We got the message here that we're just about out of time. I think we may have already run out of time, Chris. Hey, this we could go on, you and I, talking about this important issue for a lot longer here, and maybe we need to come back and revisit it, so forth. Once I publish my ideas here on how we need to organizationally change at the local level, I'd like your comments on it. So let me do that, and we'll come back to this. We may not even still be on here as we're talking.
All right, man.
But hey, thanks very much. Appreciate your views as always, and good luck with the Long Island Railroad strike.
All right, thank you.
We'll be talking to you.
All right, now, bye-bye.
Next week, militarization of police in America.